Good evening and welcome to the Danilo Husarstrup Memorial Lecture for 2008. First of all, I want to thank everyone for coming, particularly on such a beautiful evening when the sun is out and the temperature is nice and there's so many other wonderful things to do tonight, so many tickets that could be had in Toronto, and at the beginning of a holiday weekend, no less. Thank you very much for coming. In particular, I want to thank the family of Danilo Husarstrup, who are here, his mother, his widow, his sister, and all the rest of his family that is here. This lecture series was instituted to commemorate the memory of Danilo Strup, whom I'm sure most of you know, but let me remind you, Danilo was a professor at this university who was particularly well known for his work not only as a teacher, but also as an organizer. He was the editor-in-chief of the Encyclopedia of Ukraine project here at the University of Toronto. And in fact, as part of that work, he became the institutional founder of the presence of the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies on this campus. And this lecture series is sponsored by the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies, by the Danilo Husarstrup Program in Ukrainian Literature, which of course was founded, as this lecture series was, to honor his memory. Danilo wasn't only a teacher, a scholar, and an organizer. He was a man of boundless energy, and one of his great skills was building institutions. And this lecture series, it may be a little bit grandiloquent to call it an institution, but nevertheless, for scholars, something that happens year after year and is an opportunity to share what we do, that is scholarship, is an important event, and hopefully this lecture series will continue long into the future. It was created not only to honor Danilo's memory, but also to give voice to a special area of Ukrainian studies that he was particularly concerned with, Ukrainian literature. And Ukrainian literature talked about in English, that is, Ukrainian literature for a clientele more than just our own Ukrainian public, which has its own lecture series and various opportunities to talk about Ukrainian literature. Ukrainian literature has a relatively small presence in the world. Those of us like Danilo, like me, who pursue this field for a living, do what we can to enlarge this sphere of knowledge, and hopefully this lecture series will help in that direction. An area of particular importance for us in promoting Ukrainian literature is contemporary Ukrainian literature, which is very vibrant, very interesting, often crazy, but that's what contemporary literature is everywhere. And today we are particularly fortunate in that we can focus on that particular area, contemporary Ukrainian literature. And we have as our speaker one of the few experts on contemporary Ukrainian literature who exist in our diaspora world, at least, so those who are capable of speaking about Ukrainian contemporary literature in English. Dr. Marko Andrejczyk is also a particularly appropriate speaker for us today because he was a student of Danilo Strup's. That is, Danilo Strup passed away before Dr. Andrejczyk finished his studies, but he had the benefit of studying with Danilo Strup, and I'm sure there are fond memories, or not so fond, but students don't say that to us in public, of his experiences with Professor Strup. Marko Andrejczyk finished his PhD here at the University of Toronto in our department only a few years ago, which doesn't mean there isn't much to say about him. It just means that the accomplishments are all squeezed into a few years. As I've said, he is a specialist on contemporary Ukrainian literature. That was the subject of his dissertation and continues to be the area of his primary intellectual focus. Since graduating with a PhD from this university, Dr. Andrejczyk has held some distinguished positions. He has been a Sklar Fellow at Harvard University's Ukrainian Research Institute, and he is, in fact, this year, and perhaps even into the future, Shevchenko Scientific Society in the United States Fellow at Columbia University. That is, he holds a fellowship from Enteshav, which allows him to hold a position at Columbia University as an instructor. I don't want to take up more of your time or of his time, because I suspect what he has to say is far more interesting. So I invite you to welcome Dr. Marko Andrejczyk, who will talk to us about new influences of the intellectual in post-Soviet Ukrainian literature. Please welcome Dr. Andrejczyk.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Professor Turnowski, for your introduction and for inviting me to speak this evening. I also want to thank the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies for organizing and sponsoring this series every year. Greetings to the family of Danilo Strug. Dobry večer to all of you, and thanks for coming to my talk, to everyone. I always look forward to these spring lectures in the past. I had the opportunity to visit four of them, and it was always great. The semester was basically over. Spring was in full bloom. Summer is just around the corner, and it was always really nice in this beautiful room with this balcony and all this wood. There used to be more wood, I believe, but this beautiful room. And I'm honored to be counted on to continue this great tradition. As Professor Tarnowski has already revealed to you, late last year's speaker, Mirosław Shkandry, I am an alumnus of the University of Toronto. Thus my introduction will be a bit nostalgic. I found out that I was accepted to the program here at University of Toronto while I was in Ukraine. And when I shared this news with my friends there, they said, "Oh, good, Chudov, Toronto. It's a, quote, good place to be Ukrainian." Now, I came to Toronto for many reasons. I was familiar with the activity of Kyivs and the publications. I came because I knew that there were a lot of Ukrainian community institutions which offered opportunities for Ukrainian culture to be presented and discussed. And of course, I came because of the strength of the Ukrainian program at the University of Toronto. I learned much by studying under and working with Professor Tarnowski and with Professor Taras Poznarski. Professor Tarnowski was my guide through my academic program here. And it's interesting, as I teach or do research or write something now, it seems that every class that I had here continues to inform my work somehow, even Old Church Slavonic, believe it or not. I'd like to take this opportunity to express my gratitude, because I don't know if I ever got a chance to do this. I graduated and I was out of here quickly, but I do want to take this opportunity to thank the Canadian Foundation for Ukrainian Studies for the financial support I received that allowed me to complete my work here. My wife and I enjoyed our 6 years in Toronto, six or so years. We made great friends here, and it's always great to come back to this city. In the last 3 years, I have lost the Toronto accent, which I apparently, according to my friends and family back in Philadelphia, had picked up during my years here. So thankfully, my mom now cannot make fun of me for this accent during Thanksgiving dinner, which now, for some reason, is in November, I believe. I came here in the fall of 1998, Philly accent still intact, eager to study Ukrainian literature. And one of the courses I took in my first semester was a course in contemporary Ukrainian literature, which was taught by Professor Danilo Strug. And as was mentioned, I was one of the last students, the last graduate student of Professor Strug. To this day, I finally remember Professor Strug's lessons in contemporary Ukrainian literature. This was the only course I had the opportunity to take with him. We would sit in his corner office on Sussex Street, overlooking Fort Book, the library, and for about 2 hours, we would just discuss the experimental poetry of Luvosad, the plays of Yuri Tarnowski, the prose of Yuri Prokhasko, among other literary works. And this, I believe, was the first time that most of this contemporary Ukrainian literature was taught as a course, and that includes Ukraine. I think this was the first time this was ever taught. Of course, there are now several courses taught, including one of my own, in this, but this, I think that should be noted, that that was one of the first. And I learned a lot from Professor Strug in this course. He was quick to point out which works he considered to be, well, how do you say, less than great. But then he would discuss the works he loved with this great enthusiasm, which he was able to pass on quite well. And a little anecdote, when I was to hand in my final paper for this course, it was the spring of 1999. And if anybody remembers, TTC was on strike. And I was living around Izenkin-Dundas area, but I had to turn my paper in. So what do? I was flying to Ukraine the next day. So what I ended up doing was walking my paper over to Professor Strug's residence, Bloor Street, Bloor West Village. I highly recommend, it's a very satisfying way to finish a course, is to walk a paper over 40 minutes, and you worked on it for so many days, and you're walking this over, and you hand it in. Sadly, that was my last contact with Professor Strug. Now, being that the only course I ever took with Professor Strug was one in contemporary Ukrainian literature, I believe that it's particularly fitting that it is also the topic of my talk today. I will be discussing the first new wave of prose works to appear in post-Soviet Ukraine in the 1990s, some of which we had discussed in the class. As was mentioned, my talk is entitled New Images of the Intellectual in Post-Soviet Ukrainian Literature. And during my talk, I will read several excerpts of literary works. So I have a handout for you, which you can refer to as we're reading them. In the late 1980s, as the Soviet Union was fading from existence, a new generation of Ukrainian writers emerged to challenge inherited norms in Ukrainian culture and to explore questions of Ukrainian identity in art. The new Ukrainian prose works that were written at this time experimented with both form and with content, and they often featured Ukrainian intellectuals as chief protagonists. This was done deliberately because these writers designated these protagonists, these intellectuals, as sites where the post-Soviet Ukrainian identity would be explored. The writers who focus most on the Ukrainian intellectual in their prose and who are analyzed in my talk this evening, Volodymyr Dibrova, Konstantin Moskalets, Oksana Zabushko, Yuri Andruchovich, and Yevhenia Kononenko, these writers are among those contemporary Ukrainian culture figures who are often identified with the term Vesnadesyatniki, the 80s, the 80s generation. Now, these writers come from different corners of Ukraine. There's quite a large age difference. The oldest one, I believe, Dibrov, was born in 1951, while Moskalets, the youngest, 1963. And this term, Vesnadesyatniki, it's an inexact term. It's a lot of people, some of these writers, among some of those people, do not like this term, but it's been used quite consistently over the last 15 years, and there have been several publications published which use this term, and I'm using it today to refer to this group of people. In other words, these are people who first debuted, most of them started writing poetry, and that came out in the late 80s, thus, Vesnadesyatniki, but basically they were the first generation to really appear in the 90s. So all of the texts that I'm going to be talking about today were written and first published between 1990 and 2001. Never in the history of Ukrainian literature has the Ukrainian intellectual been given so much attention in literature as in the period under discussion tonight. And accordingly, among the major achievements that these writers made to Ukrainian culture is their introduction of three new prototypes of the Ukrainian intellectual to Ukrainian literature. And I've given these names: the swashbuckling performer, the ambassador to the West, and the sick soul. And when using the term intellectual this evening, I should also, a couple words on that. I'm referring to creative individuals, chiefly artists, and also those including critics and scholars who devote their lives to the analysis and interpretation of the creative activity of such individuals. Existing studies of intellectuals have generally focused on relationships that intellectuals have with government and with society. Scholars have often offered several prototypes of the intellectual, which reflect different configurations of these relationships. Just to give you a couple that have been put forth in the past, the philosopher kings. These are an exclusive group with a moral obligation to use their talents in the service of truth. Or messianic Bohemians. They're members of an elite and have a vision of progress in a world in revolution. Court jesters. These are people who have a position outside the social rank, and this affords them the freedom and the duty to question authority. And Robin Hoods. Individuals who rationally research suppressed sources and outwit their opponents in debate. Now, throughout the different eras of Ukrainian literature, leading up to the appearance of the Visi Nesyatniki, the intellectual as a protagonist was depicted as having shifting relations with fellow citizens and with government over the years. Just a quick review. Late 19th century Ukrainian literature, driven by the ideals of populism, was dominated by the image of a rural-oriented intellectual, a member of a more widely defined intelligentsia, who worked tirelessly to educate and improve the lot of the Ukrainian peasant, who was brutally exploited by the ruling class. Such intellectuals are best represented in the prose works of Ivan Franko and Ivan Chuy-Levitsky. Early modernist writings of Olga Kobylyanska, Vladimir Vinichenko, Tanhil Krimsky, among others, distinguished themselves from their predecessors by entertaining the turn-of-the-century idea of art for art's sake, and by flirting with decadence in their writings. Prose works which increasingly featured urban settings. These writers, however, were still largely concerned with serving the narod, the Ukrainian people, often at the expense of their personal aesthetic convictions. It was this conflict, in fact, that drove the best works of this period. 1920s Ukrainian Soviet writers, Nikola Khvilyuvy, Yanovsky, featured highly idealistic revolutionary intellectuals protagonists who became increasingly disillusioned with their political surroundings, which they initially championed as they strove to create the all-encompassing art of the future. Later, the intellectual of Ukrainian socialist realism was depicted as a positive hero chiefly involved in fighting bourgeois nationalist sabotage of the Soviet system and in vanquishing any impediments to fulfilling that system's economic objectives. During the Khrushchev thaw, the Shesta Desyatniki in the 1960s generation benefited from loosening of official restraints on aesthetics and by rehabilitation of the writers of the executed Renaissance, Vasilyev and Drozhenev, which was the generation from the 20s, who had become especially influential on their worldview on these 1960s. The underground unofficial cultural scenes of 1970s and 1980s, which were centered primarily in Kyiv and in Lviv, they proved to be very influential on the soon-to-emerge Visi Nesyatniki. These intellectuals were concerned, above all else, with aesthetic freedom and focused on the exploration of the vast expanse of world culture, particularly cultural achievements that were banned in the Soviet Union. They maintained a largely hermetic existence, and although they were less publicly political than the Shesta Desyatniki, they too were often persecuted by the Soviet system. The final years of the Soviet Union and the initial years of Ukrainian independence were an era of festivals in Ukraine, during which the underground culture of the 1970s and the 1980s surfaced, and it led the spirit of change that had enkindled society at the time. Having developed a functioning parallel unofficial cultural movement, replete with the creation, presentation, and critique of literature, visual art, and music, and in possession of a grassroots network of dissemination, these intellectuals were primed to take charge of cultural events as the governing structures of the Soviet system collapsed around them. Previously banned and/or restricted cultural developments from the West, especially rock music and sexual themes, they attracted fidgety Ukrainian youth to mass gatherings which celebrated the liberation of this contraband. Literary groups, most notably Bubahu, but also Propala Ramata and Lumasad, they were at the center of such grand cultural festivals. And Ukrainian prose written at this time reflected the period's mood of celebration, often tapping into it to pilot a deconstruction of Soviet, both Soviet and Ukrainian national myths. And in such literary works, a Ukrainian intellectual, the protagonist in a work of prose, was often presented as being an enchanting performer or a mover of masses. Such a literary hero is undoubtedly best represented in the prose of Yuri Andropovich, particularly in his third novel, Perversia, Perversion. That novel's chief protagonist, the Ukrainian poet Stanislav Perfetsky, represents Ukraine during a gathering of intellectuals at a Venice conference in the final years of the 20th century. The central cultural event of this conference is a presentation of an opera entitled Orpheus in Venice. As the opera is being staged, Perfetsky transforms from being its spectator to acting as one of its performers. While trying to escape a subsequent attempt to assassinate him, Perfetsky, this Ukrainian poet, he swings on a rope like a musketeer. He lands on stage during production and assumes the stage role of Orpheus. Andropovich's Ukrainian intellectual is charming, is witty, he's multi-talented, and he's quite the Lothario. The author provides numerous opportunities for other characters to express their awe as they watch and or listen to him. For example, the opera production in which Perfetsky had performed is later reviewed in a Venice newspaper, and that's the first handout you have there. So this is from the newspaper, this is a review of the opera. The appearance on stage of a little-known novice in the role of Orpheus at first gave birth to a certain skeptical misunderstanding among the exacting audience. Then the distinct organicity of the performing method of the latter, the expressiveness and refinement in each gesture or bend of the head, the decorous vocal gifts, and his top physical readiness provide all the grounds to affirm the appearance of a new star on the Venice opera horizon. The myth of Orpheus complements nicely this crowd-wooing artist that center Andropovich's prose, and the myth is often referenced by the author in his writings. In this instance, Perfetsky, a representative of a nation that the West is largely ignorant of, accidentally obtains an opportunity to enhance representatives of the West once he is provided with a platform for such a performance. And it's interesting how some of you may recall how in 2004, December 5th, 2004, when Yuri Andropovich was invited to address European Parliament in Strasbourg during the Orange Revolution, as he began his speech, he ended up quoting his character, Stanislav Perfetsky, from a speech that Perfetsky delivered in his work of fiction in Venice. And Andropovich used it quite beautifully, and the way I saw it was this Ukrainian intellectual who really wanted to tell the world about Ukraine, at least from his point of view, and come destroy some myths about it that he didn't like, was finally given this opportunity. And he used the quoting of Perfetsky, I'll read it to you, to do this. He says, "The hero of one of my novels, Stanislav Perfetsky, when he delivered a lecture before a no less worthy audience," and he's describing his novel, and he says, "and the fact of the matter isn't that I don't have anything to say. It's quite the opposite. I have so much to say about everything. And so it's kind of interesting, this little twist, how an approach quarters his own character, Kropotsky. Now, in an earlier novel, Moskovyada, Andropovich's protagonist, Otto, is a Ukrainian poet studying at the Literary Institute in Moscow, surrounded by soon-to-be relics of the dysfunctional Soviet Empire. Scenes in the novel show this Ukrainian intellectual acting like a secret agent from a Hollywood thriller at times. He battles and outwits the evil henchmen of the Empire on his way to locating the center of evil. And this swashbuckler image for the Ukrainian intellectual, whose chief role is to perform and impress the masses, is a new one for Ukrainian literature. One that is quite different from the Ukrainian intellectual of the past, who had steadfastly worked for the good of the people, sacrificing his or her personal ambitions in the process. This performer also works for the good of Ukraine, but by leading it through his or her talents in creativity and in performance. This new prototype of the Ukrainian intellectual correlates with this era of festivals, during which the death of the Soviet Union was celebrated through cultural expression by young Ukrainian artists. So that's the first new prototype I'm presenting today. Accompanying the revelry of the early 1990s Ukraine was a suddenly available access to the West. Both the burning desire to catch up to the West and the inundation of Western pop culture in Ukraine made an imprint on the prose of the Vesemnesyatniki. And in addition to this swashbuckling performer, these writers also introduced another new prototype of the intellectual to Ukrainian literature. This, as I call it, ambassador to the West. Such Ukrainian intellectuals' protagonists were instrumental in introducing the West to their fellow countrymen and in acting as a link to the West. The Vesemnesyatniki introduced the West to post-Soviet Ukraine three ways. They regularly referred to artifacts from the West in their prose. They actually send their intellectuals protagonists to the West, and they share these characters' observance of the West with readers back home. The prose works of the Vesemnesyatniki under analysis in today's talk are marked by frequent name-dropping, people, places, and things that were still quite exotic to Ukraine in the early 1990s. We forget how new this was all at the time. Оксана Забужко's novel, Польові дослідження українського сексу, Field Research in Ukrainian Sex, is the story of a Ukrainian intellectual who is living in the United States in the capacity of a visiting scholar. Consequently, academic and cultural institutions, such as the Kennan Institute in Washington, the Chicago Art Institute, the Penn Club, they're mentioned throughout the novel. Andruchowicz's novels, in their frequent lists, people who have read Andruchowicz, you know, he's very fond of using lists. He often provides a sampler of Western cultural figures and products. Tom Waits, the singer Tom Waits, the erotic French film Emmanuel Four, they're all in the same list. And a myriad of slang terms in various Western European languages. Yuri Isaryk's novel, What's It?, contains many references to Western high and pop cultural phenomena, including those made to Western rock bands such as King Crimson, The Velvet Underground, and Queen, as well as to their Eastern European counterparts like Mana and Plastic People of the Universe. One part of the novel includes a lengthy list of cliched images associated with various places in the world, mostly. And this is the second excerpt on your handout. Summer in Hawaii, an evening on Broadway, skateboarding in Florida, surfing in the Bahamas, the festival in Cannes, a weekend in Disneyland. What else? Skiing in the Carpathians, love in Paris, bordellos in Amsterdam, beer in Bavaria, hockey in Canada, reggae in Jamaica, roulette in Monte Carlo, skyscrapers in New York, cigars in Cuba, war in Yugoslavia, gold in Alaska, hunting in Africa, immigrants at Brighton Beach, terrorists in Palestine, Nirvana in India, oil in the Emirates, art in Montmartre, Gauguin in Tahiti, rock in Woodstock, Heidi Kitty in Kyoto, carnival in Brazil, healing in Lourdes, the Gioconda at the Louvre, death in Venice, the bazaar in Chernivtsi, corruption in high places, a bullfight in Toledo, a miracle in Milan, an inferno in the Tower, the Pope in the Vatican, the Tower in Babel, the bomb in Hiroshima, the rumba in Barbados, a caravan in the desert, the Queen of England, a sauna in Finland, Lenin in the mausoleum, shadows in paradise, the sarcophagus in Chernobyl, can-can in the Moulin Rouge, cheese and butter, bird in the hand, two in the bush, Lucy in the sky, islands in Oceania, Alice in Wonderland, the fool on the hill, in Vino Veritas, the festival that is always with you. This is wonderfully translated by Marco Publish and published by Kiwis recently. Now the lengthiness and repetitive rhythm of this deluge of coordinates in this list simulate the dizziness experienced by inhabitants of the post-Soviet space, who suddenly were inundated with immense amounts of previously restricted data. Cities, countries, and nations are reduced to one convenient and efficient image. Isidore commingles these with figures such as Lenin and the Pope, as well as with popular songs, books, and phrases in order to announce the arrival of Western pop cultural sensibilities to Ukraine. It was the 1990s. The West had come to Ukraine, and Ukrainians were coming to the West. When the Soviet Union collapsed, Ukrainian intellectuals were among the first to travel to the West. They represented Ukraine as ambassadors at various academic and cultural events. Zabushko's protagonist in field research, she travels between U.S. cities telling her American counterparts about Ukraine. Konstantin Moskaletz's narrator in the novel Which Hidden He Met, Evening Need, he travels to Munich and is given the opportunity to see how an intellectual lives in Germany, in Western society. In Yevhenia Kononenko's novel, Imitatsiya, Imitation, we are told that its chief protagonist, Mariana, has studied art in Western Europe. Andruchowicz's Perfetsky, as we have seen, gives speeches about his homeland in Venice. Sometimes in a prose work of the Vesely Myslyatniki, the Ukrainian intellectual acts as a pioneer of sorts, discovering the West and describing it from the point of view of a former citizen of the USSR. For example, in Dibrova's novel, Burdik, the narrator manages to smuggle his way into the United States and spends time observing the peculiarities of life there. He later offers the reader a two-page long description of an American supermarket. In several of the novels mentioned above, the Ukrainian intellectual functions as a go-between the West and with other citizens of Ukraine. This is particularly evident in the prose of Kononenko and Zabushko. Both in Polyvido Sliginia and in Imitatsiya, the female Ukrainian intellectual protagonists possess these main characters of theirs. They possess intelligence, beauty, and savvy, and they attract Western men, some of whom are in a position to help Ukraine. They function as conduits between Ukraine and the West, and this leads to a conflict in their personal lives. They face the dilemma of choosing between these men with their strange Western values in order to best serve their country, and Ukrainian men, who are predominantly depicted as being backward, timid, and unwilling to sway from the regulations of patriarchal Ukrainian society. One particular component of the West that is significant in the prose of the Vesely Myslyatniki is the presence of, you guessed it, the Ukrainian diaspora. These emigres offer kind of a halfway point for these post-Soviet Ukraine intellectuals visiting the West, because they're both Western and they're Ukrainian. It's this weird mix. And it is often with members of the Ukrainian diaspora that these intellectuals first make contact. It is by them that they were often invited to participate in various conferences and exchange programs. By depicting the relationship between these two types of Ukrainians, the Vesely Myslyatniki are picking through diaspora perspectives and values, accepting some while rejecting others, as they construct this post-Soviet Ukrainian identity. Now, initially, depictions of members of the diaspora are quite sympathetic. These men and women are shown to be staunch patriots of Ukraine and all things Ukraine. They devote their time and energy to the Ukrainian cause, and they have managed to maintain a Ukrainian identity outside their homeland. In Burdik, for example, the narrator describes a certain Lubomir Brinchak, an emigre librarian who organizes Ukrainian sporting events and art openings in the United States. In Polivido Svijinja, Ukrinsko Seksu, the protagonist's contact point at the Pennsylvania University she is visiting is Mark, a professor of Ukrainian background who has been successful inviting other intellectuals from Ukraine to the university. The diaspora is represented in Andruchowicz's novel Rekreatsiya by Dr. Popper, a psychiatrist residing in Switzerland who arrives at the Chortopil Festival of the Resurrecting Spirit in Ukraine on an old Chrysler Imperial. And he gives two young Ukrainian poets a ride to the festival. As these novels progress, however, representatives of the Ukrainian diaspora take on a more negative light. Brinchak turns out to be a walking cliche of Ukrainian things. He invites the novel's narrator to a traditional Ukrainian Christmas meal, with all the meals and everything according to tradition. But Christmas is months away. Brinchak is shown to be less than helpful when the narrator asks if he can stay with him for a while, and he says, well, there's a church down the street that got plenty of room. Zabushko makes sure that the reader is made aware that this Professor Mark, who invites all these intellectuals to the West, is only doing so because he's got problems at home, and just gets them out of the house, which makes a point of showing this. Finally, Dr. Popper is continually ridiculed by the young poets, who are hitching a ride with him to the festival. And in parting, they refer to him as an old mudak. Almost like a moron, it's a very negative term. In fact, Popper, as we later see in the novel, turns out to be not just an old mudak, but a demon who attempts to drag one of the poets into a sacrifice ritual. As the examples above illustrate, newfound access to the West was very influential on the first wave of post-Soviet prose. The cult of the West and its materials are both sustained and ridiculed in these works. Western things in the West itself appears in the prose, and Ukrainian intellectuals assume the duty of discovering, investigating, and filtering these artifacts and trades as they search for the post-Soviet Ukrainian identity. It is a search that consumes these intellectual protagonists, and it often damages them as a result. The aura of celebration that marked the early years of Ukraine independence and the opening up of previously inaccessible worlds that accompanied it were also quickly joined by the general disorientation for the Ukraine intellectual as the 1990s progressed. Having led the calls for reform and having manifested the energy of change in their art, Ukrainian artists once again found themselves on the periphery of a Ukraine controlled by former Communist Party leaders freshly repackaged as National Democrats. The disillusionment of the Ukrainian intellectual stemming from this is expressed in the prose of Lvivi Myslavniki, where the Ukrainian intellectual protagonist is frequently depicted as being different, or abnormal, or sick. Zabushko's Polivido Svijinja, in many ways, is an extended rant exposing the various ills infecting all of Ukraine, more specifically the Ukrainian woman, and even more specifically the Ukrainian female intellectual. Incapable of coming to terms with her nation's cruel history and ignoring its present maladies, she becomes infected with the ills of her people and suffers from this. The artist applies art to this wound in hopes of eventually curing it. Now, this is the third excerpt you have there. A short course in psychology, the road to mental health. Find the reason and the problem goes away. Why hasn't anyone thought of doing this with nations? You neatly psychoanalyze the whole national history and poof, a cure. Literature is a form of national therapy. Not a bad idea. Too bad that we happen to have no literature. This is from Oksana Zabushko's novel. Zabushko often employs a jagged style which effectively portrays this raving madness overcoming a person submitting themselves to this dangerous task. In her novel, Zabushko attacks her nation's problems with aggression, undertaking sort of catharsis in order to rid it of pain, as she probes deeper and deeper in search of the roots of the evil that entangled her people. She herself becomes snarled by Russian imperial ambitions, the Ukrainian inferiority complex, and an all-encompassing, paralyzing fear that governs her people. Idrik Zvotsik is a novel in which sickness and pain figure heavily in defining oneself. During incessant interwoven scenes of non-action, The protagonist is shown to exist almost entirely within his mind and seems to require pain in order to make a connection with his body. Excerpt number 4. But return seemed inevitable, and return meant only pain. Only pain now. Pain now substituted for the whole world. The whole world was pain. He listened and found out that this was not pain at its best. Wozzeck tries to find an approach, a position through which the whole world would not be pain. Shifting through philosophical systems admixed with 20th century pop culture, trying them on for size, Wozzeck is unable to find a compatible ideal in this world, and as such has difficulty establishing his own being. The sickness of the Ukrainian intellectual artist is also manifested in the prose of the Vyesemisadniki when these artists are shown to be treading a path of self-destruction, usually abetted by the consumption of alcohol. For example, in the Brovas Burdik, the title character, who is a representative of this lost generation of late Soviet Ukrainian intellectuals, this character spends the last moments of his life in an intoxicated state, having drunk a fatal quantity of cognac. Self-destructive alcoholism is even more present in the prose of Andropovich and in Moskalets. The reader of Rekrati, Andropovich's first novel, is shown how one of the novel's young poets, Martofiak, had provoked his wife. This is number 5 in your handout. This is Marta Martofiak talking about her husband, this poet. He gave me an ultimatum. If I didn't go, he'd get dead drunk in Chertovia. Shit drunk, raving drunk, drunk day and night. He would drink all he could get, throw up, and drink again until they brought him home all but dead. Marta does end up attending the festival, but Martofiak, along with his other poet buddies, nonetheless begin drinking as soon as they meet up, an activity that constitutes much of the action in the novel. Moskoviada's hero, this is the second Andropovich novel, Otto, he also drinks throughout his jaunts around Moscow, and he eventually classifies the alcohol in his body in layers. That's number 6. Meanwhile, you mentally conduct a lengthwise autopsy of yourself. This, it seems, will make it easier to concentrate and get to the essence. So then, at the very bottom we have beer, about 3 or 4 liters of a yellow, murky drink, brewed especially for the proletariat. Above it is a warm and red layer of wine. There, tectonic processes are initiated. These are volcanic depths. Next, there's a relatively narrow layer of vodka, rising about halfway up the esophagus. This is a very active layer in a biological sense, at a certain moment, and can become a catalyst for great innovative tendencies. It is, in other words, gunpowder. Above the vodka, closer to the throat, lies Kaveh, fortified grape drink. In the event of an eruption, this is the first thing you spew out, like a fountain. It's smelly and brown, like petroleum. And this, in general, is the blueprint of your inner emptiness. We won't mention blood and everything else for now. So here, Andropovich addresses both this prominent position of alcohol in the daily life of a Soviet citizen and the toll it takes on its consumers. The omnipresence of alcohol in Andropovich's prose is not surprising, given the scenes of revelry that marks this era of festivals that I mentioned in the beginning. However, his protagonist's dependence on alcohol is deliberately presented in a pathetic light, and usually includes self-reflective criticism, as illustrated by the fragment we just read at the very end. Now, the main character in the first part of Moskaletz's novel, Vychidny Med, the characters in this novel, they constitute a small group of bohemian artists living in Lviv. These men spend their days discussing deep philosophical topics, all while trying to figure out where and with what means to purchase one more bottle of high-proof alcohol. In fact, we rarely see these characters presented in a sober state. Often the scenes in which they are presented are quite humorous, driven by dialogues filled with looping rhetoric. And this is number 7 in here. And then out of nowhere, the nectar bar rises up, or maybe is created, right in front of them. Sitting by its entrance are a very pale Dem and a very red Yellow. "What's up, Dem, you nut?" yells Bumper. "You want to have a drink?" "I'm buying." Dem doesn't say anything. "He's gotta have a drink," Conway explains below. "He's flipped out and hasn't said a word for 3 hours in a row." "Who in a row is gonna go to the store?" shouts Bumper. "Are we going to, in a row, save Dem? Or not, you in a row jerks?" "Stop yelling, Bumper," Lord Krishna says quietly. "I'll go, just stop yelling." "Shut up, I in a row command you," says Bumper, becoming frantic. "Give me the dough," Krishna says. Sighs. Bumper gets the dough and starts counting it. There's a lot of dough. He'll come out the 3 bottles of sweet, sweet port for Kisser. Bilo and Trotsky glance at one another. Maybe that's a bit excessive, but it's too late. Alcohol has consumed these artists' lives. Today's watering holes and stores selling beer form the topography of Lviv, alongside its 16th century churches, its 15th century fortification walls, and its 14th century cobblestone streets. However, it is only the bars that miraculously appear in front of these artists' eyes as they're strolling through the city. These bars appear and act as snares that prove to be impossible to avoid for these artists. In this novel, hangovers have actually been personified, and they themselves stroll the streets of Lviv. Moskaletz is effective in presenting the severity of these men's sickness in a scene where hallucinations have taken over one of the artist's mind. This is the final. The only thing Trotsky feared and truly respected was the white squirrel. The white squirrel had a puffy tail and 4 paws, a jittery, well-intentioned animal carrying a crystal shot glass on a silver tray. He tamed it about 5 years ago, but still hadn't gotten his fill of its extraordinary wisdom and companionship. It would often visit Trotsky. It's Trotsky, not Trotsky. This is his nickname. It's not. It would often visit Trotsky in the most unexpected places, in the bathroom, in underground passages, in the streetcar, in bed. Sometimes it would jump up onto the table at the Nectar bar. Sometimes it would run along the bar in the basement of Under the Tower. Trotsky kept rioting, napping, and sleepily pondering the white squirrel's love for the hangover, until someone vigorously knocked on the streetcar window. Trotsky opened one eye and saw that it was Smetana. Smetana had died 2 years ago, having poisoned himself with antifreeze, and Trotsky was well aware of this, but nonetheless became uneasy. So in this fragment, bars are once again listed together with everyday activities and places in the city. And this hallucination becomes something that is feared, but also respected. Mentions of death and the use of toxins ingested in order to reach an intoxicated state point to artists who are affected with a serious illness. Their self-destruction is an attempt to escape from the world around them, a world that stubbornly hangs on to its Soviet past, and perhaps equally appallingly, steadily adopts new hyper-materialistic values which conflict with the convictions and the vision of Ukraine maintained by these Ukrainian intellectuals. The suffering artist, as a character, had existed briefly in Ukrainian literature, most prominently in the early modernist prose of Kubilyanska. Virtually non-existent in the Soviet period of Ukrainian literature, it has manifested itself as a new prototype of Ukrainian literature in post-Soviet art. The presentation of such characters is crucial in expressing the self-image of the Vesnesyatniki, of their marginalization and their alienated state within independent Ukraine. These 3 new images of the Ukrainian intellectual and Ukrainian literature appear during a period in the country's history that was filled with great changes. With their protagonists and with their prose, the Vesnesyatniki capture the excitement and the confusion of the 1990s. The Vesnesyatniki chose to focus on the post-Soviet Ukrainian intellectual as a site where the Ukrainian identity would be explored and created. As post-Soviet Ukraine advanced in years, these writers, with their artist protagonists in tow, came to gradually inhabit the vacuum that had occupied the intellectual's niche in society during Soviet times. The difficulty and sometimes futility that their characters experienced as they began this learning process is reflective of the complexity and the tribulation that the Vysimitsiakniki continued to have in establishing and filling the intellectual position in post-Soviet Ukraine. Boris Dubin writes that intellectuals are involved in creating symbols of individual and collective identity, and with arranging, refining, transmitting, and recreating them. Throughout these prose works, these intellectuals' protagonists are shown to be juggling and manipulating a whole catalog of components that contribute to Ukrainian identity. They have flipped through a storage bank of the traits that they acquired, both from the narratives of colonizers and from Ukrainian national myths. They have also introduced new aspects to this identity. These intellectuals have sampled elements of the West, accepting some of them while rejecting others. On the pages of their prose, the Vysimitsiakniki have shown us how an intellectual protagonist combines symbols of Ukraine identity and how this process is reflected in the protagonist's own creative process within the novel. And it's through this riveting and varied literature that nuances of the post-Soviet Ukraine identity become exposed. Present readers and students like myself several years ago, and for future writers. Thank you.